I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Eye on the Economy. Vice President Harris and former President Trump are back on the campaign trail, and one topic is commanding their attention: balance of power. Results are in after two Midwestern states hold primary elections. What it could mean for the next Congress. Gaining strength. A hurricane is headed toward Bermuda after leaving tens of thousands in Puerto Rico without power. And the beauty of faith. A look at a masterpiece depicting tomorrow's Feast of the Assumption of Mary. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Maximilian Kolbe, our top story tonight. We are back on the campaign trail following Donald Trump and Kamala Harris and their fight to win the White House in November. With Election Day less than 3 months away, today is all about the economy, both campaigns focusing their message on easing the pain of the current cost of living. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, tonight both campaigns are obviously well aware of how high prices are hurting people across the country. And a new AP NORC poll finds that Americans are more likely to trust Trump over Harris when it comes to handling the economy. 45% for Trump, 38% for Harris.
Casting his primary election ballot during early voting in Florida, former President Donald Trump discusses the economy.
It's gone very bad under this group of people with inflation, with the economy itself, and so many other things.
And on the stump in Michigan, near Grand Rapids, his vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, with a similar message.
When Kamala Harris raised the price of American energy, Michigan suffered, you suffered.
The Ohio senator pinning the blame for inflation on President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Vance's comments come as year-over-year inflation reached its lowest level in more than 3 years in July. In the White House press briefing room, Jared Bernstein, chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, telling reporters inflation is coming down, but also acknowledging,
but there are too many prices that are still too high. And I think that's one of the reasons for the disconnect that you described, for some of the negative vibes that you described. And, I have three words for people who feel the way you just said, which is, we hear you. The president hears you. The vice president hears you.
The Trump campaign blasted today's Labor Department report, saying America cannot afford another 4 years of Kamala's failed economic policies. But the Harris campaign warning, if Trump wins, he'll drop an inflation bomb. So how is the economy doing from the perspective of someone not running for office? One expert described it for us in these terms.
What we're seeing now is that even though there is the inflation rate is leveling off, it is still a higher rate than it was 4 years ago. So everything that anybody buys in the marketplace is in a supermarket is 20% higher than it was than 4 years ago.
Back on the campaign trail, Harris plans to be in North Carolina on Friday to discuss building up the middle class. And tomorrow, she and President Biden will be in Maryland to talk about lowering costs for Americans. Today, the president also spoke about the economy, addressing content creators at the White House.
Yes, yes, yes. I told you we're going to have a soft landing. We're going to have a soft landing. My policies are working. Start right in that way, okay?
Now, late this afternoon, former President Trump held a rally in Asheville, North Carolina, discussing the economy. North Carolina has 16 electoral votes, and Trump won that state in 2020 by a narrow margin. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Owen. Well, the judge overseeing former President Trump's hush money trial says that he will not step aside from the case. Trump's attorneys have continually asked Judge Mershon to remove himself because his daughter works for Democratic campaigns. The judge says those arguments have been repeatedly denied by higher courts and no new facts warrant a review. Trump was convicted of 34 felony counts. He is set to be sentenced next month. As Republicans and Democrats fight for control of Congress, the results are in from primary elections in a handful of states, and now the showdowns are taking shape that could determine the balance of power on Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now from the studio with the latest. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, the big story, after several progressives in the U.S. House lost their primary elections, the group, or also known as the Squad, did claim a victory last night as Congresswoman Ilhan Omar fended off her primary challenger to take home the win. It comes 1 week after fellow Squad member Cori Bush of Missouri lost her bid and Congressman Jamel Bowman of New York was defeated earlier this week. Victory speech for Ilhan Omar, she said that the campaign was run filled with joy.
We know it is joyful to fight for healthcare to be a human right. We know it is joyful to want to live in a peaceful and equitable world.
Omar's victory caps a series of primaries facing the Squad that have been the target of millions of dollars from pro-Israel groups, including the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, as Democrats continue to split over Israel's actions in Gaza. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, the Badger State Senate race is now set. Businessman Eric Hovde, as expected, won his primary and will take on Senator Tammy Baldwin in November, in what's expected to be one of the most competitive races for the upper chamber.
She seems to only come back into the state when it's time for election and does stage events and doesn't want to, you know, talk about her record. Making up lies not only about me, taking things completely out of context, but also even embellishing her record.
After her victory, Senator Baldwin released a statement, quote, "Tonight I'm honored to receive the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate to continue our fight to lower costs for Wisconsin families, stand up for American jobs and manufacturing, and restore our reproductive freedoms." Also in Wisconsin, Republican businessman Tony Weed, a Catholic, backed by former President Donald Trump, won the Republican primary in the state's 8th congressional district. He will also fill out the term of Mike Gallagher, who left the House in April.
We have so many issues in our country right now with the, you know, the radical agenda of the Democratic Party at this point. And people are saying, hey, we're not better off now than we were 4 years ago. We need change. We need good, strong, conservative values in Washington, and I'm going to bring that.
As we know, Republicans currently control the U.S. House by a razor-thin margin, and Democrats have to pick up just a handful of seats to reclaim the lower chamber in 2025. The election map isn't entirely set just yet. There's still about a half a dozen primaries coming up, including in Wyoming, Alaska, and Florida, and that's where Republican Senator Rick Scott is running for re-election. Tracy.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric, in the studio for us tonight. Well, the Trump campaign says Iran is behind the recent hack that led to sensitive internal documents being stolen and distributed. The FBI says that it is investigating, but gave no further details. The Trump campaign told the BBC the documents were illegally obtained by foreign adversaries and specifically mentioned Iran. And joining us now is Jonathan Saya, research analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he focuses in part on Iranian domestic affairs. Jonathan, thank you for being with us tonight. We appreciate it. As mentioned, the FBI is investigating the alleged Iranian cyber attack on the Trump campaign, and apparently the Harris campaign was also targeted by foreign hackers. I know you know Iran very well. What is your sense? Do you think Iran is indeed behind these activities? And if so, what's their objective?
Hi, Iran, for the longest time, the regime at Tehran has been seeking to influence U.S. elections, dating back as far as 2020. This specific new incident underscores their fear of a potential Trump re-election, given the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign that both targeted the Iranian economy as well as their military infrastructure and also diplomatically isolated Iran. Given that the Iranian regime greatly fears the domestic uprisings against their own rule, the economy has been the greatest Achilles heel of the regime. So the maximum pressure campaign that greatly focused on expanding sanctions on Iran, as well as enforcing them very, very rigorously, damaged the Iranian economy and, most important, the kleptocrats in charge of the regime. So given that history, Iran is greatly concerned with the Trump re-election, whereas now the sanctions are not being enforced as rigorously. In addition to that, there are a lot of incentives being provided to the regime, whether through unfreezing their assets or through other prisoner swap deals.
Yeah, and we're also hearing, actually, Iran is dealing with a cyber attack of its own today. The central bank of Iran was apparently targeted, as well as other banks, in what's reportedly the largest hack in the country's history. And Iran is blaming Israel and the United States for it. What more do you know about this?
Well, the reports are still circulating on specific media outlets. They're yet to be confirmed by other entities. But what we know is that there has been a history of U.S. and Israel cooperating on targeting Iran's different infrastructures, namely the military. So earlier this year, the U.S. targeted an Iranian spy ship that was providing intelligence for the Houthi terrorists in Yemen. Prior to that, in 2019, Iran was targeted by the United States regarding their weapon system. But now what we're seeing perhaps might be a shift in strategy, which is very notable. So instead of focusing on the military aspects, it seems like the United States and perhaps Israel are trying to focus on exasperating the grievances of Iranian activists inside the country. The Wall Street Journal reported, perhaps I think not that long ago, that a U.S. official, anonymous U.S. official, had stated that if Iran were to attack Israel in their latest rounds of escalations, there would be a very devastating blow to their economy. So this perhaps might be a follow-up to that threat that Iran has used its militias to attack Israel and also U.S. bases, as well as disrupting shipping lines going through the Red Sea. And this might be a shift in strategy. In addition to focusing on the military aspect, they're also trying to focus on the Iranian economy. As I mentioned, it has been the Achilles heel and definitely a regime weakness.
Jonathan, we probably have about 30 seconds left or so, but quickly, I want to know this. Do you think that we can expect to see more cyber attacks from Iran, maybe in a different form here in the U.S., and should we be concerned?
Certainly. In 2023, just last year, I think the FBI just issued a warning saying that it is very, very likely that we're going to see an intensified, I guess, influence operation campaign by Iran targeting the U.S. elections and through cyber attack and cyber warfare. The regime has been investing heavily in its cyber army through different entities. So it is very likely that we're going to see an increase in that, namely as soon as we get close to the U.S. elections.
All right, Jonathan, we're going to leave it right there. Thank you so much for coming on and providing those insights for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, the United States approves $20 billion in arms sales to Israel. This as tensions in the region reach a fever pitch. The agreement includes fighter jets, advanced air-to-air missiles, and tank ammunition. The threat against Israel remains high, with Iran expected to retaliate for the killing of top leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah. Meanwhile, a new round of ceasefire negotiations are expected to begin tomorrow. And staying in the Middle East, the Taliban celebrates the third anniversary of its return to power in Afghanistan with a military parade. The procession took place at the former U.S. military airbase in Bagram. Taliban officials lauded achievements like strengthening Islamic law in Afghanistan. According to reports, at least some of the weapons and tanks on display were left behind when the United States withdrew from Afghanistan 3 years ago. Decades of conflict and instability have left millions of people on the brink of hunger and starvation, and there is high unemployment in the country. While German prosecutors issue an arrest warrant for a Ukrainian man regarding the undersea explosion of the Nord Stream pipeline in 2022. Officials say the main suspect was living in Poland until recently. The blast came in 2022, destroying a crucial pipeline for natural gas between Russia and Germany underneath the Baltic Sea. The Kremlin accused the U.S. of helping to stage the explosions. Washington denies the claims. Japan will have a new leader. The country's prime minister says that he will not run in the upcoming party leadership vote next month. Fumio Kishida says that he wants to show his party is changing for the better. This comes after the Liberal Democratic Party faced a corruption scandal and the prime minister's popularity lowered to less than 20%. The LPD is set to decide next week on a date for the election. All right, now to political turmoil in Thailand. In a shocking move, a court removed Prime Minister Setha Thasavin from office over an ethical violation. It comes just days after the court dissolved the country's main opposition party. Setha only took office about a year ago. This case involved the Prime Minister's appointment of a cabinet member previously convicted of attempted bribery. Setha, who spoke outside the government office after the verdict, denied any wrongdoing and thanked the judges for giving him an opportunity to defend himself. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including Path of Destruction, a report from Puerto Rico as it deals with the aftermath of Hurricane Ernesto. Ernesto is now Hurricane Ernesto, and it is over the Caribbean and is expected to grow stronger on its path toward Bermuda. The storm brushed past Puerto Rico last night, bringing with it heavy rains and winds of 65 miles per hour. Forecasters have issued a hurricane watch and tropical storm warning for the U.S. and British Virgin Islands. The storm is set to be near Bermuda by Friday. All right, with more on the situation in Puerto Rico, we bring in U.S. Shadow Senator Zoraida Buxo, who joins us now from San Juan. Senator, thank you so much for coming on today. Tell us about how Ernesto has impacted the island and what you're experiencing there.
Well, first of all, thank you, Tracy, for the opportunity. We feel that danger, the greater danger is over. Tropical Storm Ernesto is gone. We had a lot of rain. And some winds. We were very ready and prepared. After going through the experience 7 years ago with Hurricane Maria, Category 5 hurricane, and in December of 2022 with Hurricane Fiona, which was a Category 1 hurricane, people were really prepared. There were over 350 shelters that were open. And just so you have an idea, we're 3.2 million American citizens here in the island. Back in Hurricane Maria, there were like 15,000 people that used the shelters. And now probably we're over prepared because we opened almost 350 shelters by the central government, public schools, community centers, even municipalities. So there was a lot of support for the families and people, but really people took preparation in their hands. And I think that that the outcome was good in terms that there were no lost lives in this occasion, and that everybody is regrouping to start a new day tomorrow, back to normal.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of, I mean, you mentioned a lot of rain. What about damages? Any flooding? Can you give us an idea of what the island has experienced?
Well, with the heavy rain, you have the conditions for flooding. There were river overflows and a lot of branches that were falling and blocked roads. But in general terms, compared to our prior experiences, this was, you know, people were ready and they're already cleaning up the areas, the municipal governments, the central government, other organizations, and the people themselves, the communities. So it's not as what has happened in the past. The major issue is always power, the electric service. But in this time, I can tell you that it was a little over a third of the population, households and businesses that lost power in this occasion, whereas during Hurricane Fiona and Maria, we had 100% a power outage. And people are experiencing the restoration of power service. So like, as I said, I'm very carefully optimistic that things will be back to normal for tomorrow.
Good. And we're praying for that as well and everyone there. Thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it, Senator.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. For more on where Hurricane Ernesto is heading next, I want to bring in Dr. Michael Brennan. He is the director of NOAA's National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today. We have heard how Hurricane Ernesto affected Puerto Rico, but can you tell us where it's moving next?
Yeah, you can see the center of Ernesto now is more than a couple hundred miles off to the northwest of Puerto Rico, but you're still getting some heavy rains. There's still flash flood warnings in effect for portions of the island, so the impacts are not quite done there yet, but eyes are now turning more towards Bermuda for direct impacts. We're expecting Ernesto to move northward and then northeastward across the western Atlantic and move near or over Bermuda by the time we get from late Friday into early Saturday. We could see tropical storm conditions beginning there Friday or Friday evening with hurricane conditions possible on Saturday. The other big story for Ernesto is going to be the surf and rip current danger that it creates for essentially the entire U.S. East Coast that's going to spread from Florida up through the Southeast and into the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast states as we go from Friday into Saturday and Sunday. So we could see dangerous beach conditions across the entire U.S. East Coast for this upcoming weekend.
And Michael, as Ernesto makes its way on its path, will it continue to gain strength?
Yeah, we're expecting Ernesto to continue at least strengthening gradually over the next couple days. We're forecasting it to reach at or near major hurricane intensity. That's a Category 3 storm by the time we get into Friday, and still be a pretty powerful hurricane as we move from Friday into Saturday, and then continue to be a hurricane all the way out through our five-day forecast period, maybe moving near Nova Scotia by the time we get into early next week as a hurricane.
Yeah, I know the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted an above normal number of storms this season. Yeah. What factors went into that forecast?
Well, there's sort of two large-scale factors that we're looking at that are going to likely make this a very busy hurricane season. The first is we have warm to near record warm ocean temperatures across much of the Atlantic basin, and that those warm waters are essentially serve as the fuel for developing tropical storms and hurricanes. The second piece is the development of La Nina across the eastern Pacific, which is expected to come into play here in the next couple of months, and that creates favorable conditions in the atmosphere for storms to form across the Atlantic basin and will allow disturbances and developing systems to go ahead and take advantage of those very warm ocean temperatures.
Michael, before I let you go, what's your biggest concern about Ernesto right now, and what should people be looking out for?
Well, if you live in Bermuda, and Bermuda is no stranger to impacts from tropical storms and hurricanes, we're likely to see a hurricane watch issued for Bermuda as soon as later this afternoon. So the folks there are going to want to look at their hurricane plan, make sure they have supplies. The thing to note about Ernesto is it's going to slow down as it moves near Bermuda, so they could have a prolonged period of impacts there. The other big impact for the U.S. East Coast is going to be the dangerous surf and rip current conditions. It could be a really nice day to otherwise be at the beach, but we lose a lot of people every year to dangerous ocean conditions from distant hurricanes that can be far off the East Coast and create dangerous surf conditions. So people want to follow any advice they're given by their lifeguards, look at any warning flags, and don't go in the ocean if they don't think it's safe.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, message from the Middle East. A church leader in Jerusalem has a special request for the faithful. Is the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. The scene has been depicted in art for centuries, including in one masterpiece from the studio of Peter Paul Rubens. And for more, we turn now to Jem Sullivan, Associate Professor at the School of Theology and Religious Studies at the Catholic University of America. Jem, always good to see you. So tell us, how long has the Assumption of Mary been depicted in art? And would early artwork would have been done in frescoes or statues?
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's always good to see you. You know, it was Pope Pius XII who in 1950 formally defined Mary's Assumption as part of Catholic doctrine. But well before that, belief in Mary's Assumption was part of Catholic devotion for centuries. And so from that long-held devotion, there were painters and sculptors, musicians and poets who brought to life in stone, paint, song, in word, in fresco, the Catholic belief in Mary's Assumption. So well before its formal definition by the Church, we have many beautiful works of art, hymns and paintings and fresco that offer a visual catechesis on Mary's Assumption. And this painting from the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. is one of them.
And Jeb, let's talk about the masterpiece now. What can you tell us about this beautiful image of Mary's Assumption from the National Gallery of Art?
So this scene is a sketch based on an altarpiece completed by Peter Paul Rubens. He was the master Baroque artist of the 17th century. And in his characteristic style, Rubens painted large biblical and religious scenes with dramatic movement and intense color. This replica is a good example of that style, and most likely it was completed by assistants in his workshop. What we see in the painting is God assuming Mary into heaven as she's carried up by angels. Everything in this painting is moving to where two angels holding a wreath of flowers are ready to crown Mary as Queen of Heaven. And then below them, we see Mary's empty tomb, surrounded by a lively group of biblical figures, both prophets and apostles. And it is thought that the gospel women named Mary are also present here. In this group, one of the apostles stands with his arms outstretched to heaven in praise of God. His perspective is meant to be our perspective as we join the church's celebration of this glorious moment when Mary's earthly life draws to a close and she's assumed to heaven.
Well, Jem, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. We really appreciate it. God bless you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, finally, tonight, a church leader in Jerusalem is asking the faithful around the world to use tomorrow's feast to pray for peace. Cardinal Pierre Battista Pizzaballa makes the appeal especially for peace in the Holy Land. It includes a prayer to Our Lady that the cardinal hopes all the faithful will recite tomorrow. He adds that prayer can change the course of the war in Gaza. And to find the prayer, visit Catholic News Agency. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.